David would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor and even his sword and his bow and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. As they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul, with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they celebrated, "Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom?" And Saul kept an eye on David from that day on. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall," but David evaded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. And David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in fearful awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and came in before them. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my elder daughter Merab. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "Let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." And David said to Saul, "Who am I, and who are my relatives, my father's clan in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?" But at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel the Meholathites for a wife. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David. And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, "Let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Therefore Saul said to David a second time, "You shall now be my son-in-law." And Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David in private and say, 'Behold, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now then, become the king's son-in-law.'" And Saul's servants spoke these words in the ears of David, and David said, "Does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and have no reputation?" And the servants of Saul told him, "Thus and so did David speak." Then Saul said, "Thus shall you say to David, 'The king desires no bride price except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged of the king's enemies.'" Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. And when the servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time had expired, David arose and went, along with his men, and killed 200 of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter Michal for a wife. But when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the commanders of the Philistines came out to battle, and as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed. This is the word of God. It's nice to be with you on this rather crazy weather day. My name's the Laird, allegedly. I don't know how I got it, but I have it, and I think it's purely ironic. I am not a landowner, so you don't need to ask me for money, sheep, or cattle after the service now. I've got to find this thing. So if we can turn together to 1 Samuel 18, and we're going to look together at a few of the themes in that chapter. It never seems as long a chapter until you start reading it publicly and think, whoa. But we won't go through it in much detail. We're just going to do a quick skim over it and deal with what I regard to be the main theme. If I was going to give a heading to this talk, it would be the heading, Dealing with Times of Testing. Dealing with Times of Testing. I don't know if you've seen the film 12 Years a Slave. It tells the story of Solomon Northup and how this free man is abducted and forced into slavery in the into the southern states of America. During and the film follows his life during those years as a slave. And as the film goes on, life just gets harder and tougher and more oppressive for Solomon. And he eventually decides to trust various men in his life, in his experience. And often they let him down. They trick him, they fool him, deceive him. And he is then found out, and then he is given more beatings and forced to do more demeaning work as the film goes on and on and on. However, this is a spoiler, by the way, so sorry about that. You should have seen it by now. It's been months out. However, after struggling with doubt as who can I really trust, he decides to put his trust into a Canadian. And the Canadian is a guy called Bass. Now, Bass, thankfully, turns out to be a help to Solomon. After countless and numerous disappointments with people, Solomon has a reason to be thankful for this person, Bass, because Bass does what he says he will do. Bass agrees to be a true friend to Solomon. Bass agrees to deliver a letter that will bring Solomon's freedom and will eventually lead to Solomon being free from peace, free from the struggles, and to enjoy peace. Now, it's a hard film to watch, but one in which we see how a man who is in desperate need humbly puts his life into the hands of his friend in the hope that he will escape his trouble and find peace. And what we find in the verses we've just read in Solomon is kind of reflected in that what we see is David, a man who is utterly dependent on not a man, but on God for help during his time of trouble. And through his humble dependence upon God, David finds peace from his trouble. In the previous chapter, as 1 Samuel 17, we had the most sensational story. A teenage boy had just defeated the most feared serving soldier in the Philistine army, a shepherd boy, one who had no experience of the battlefield, who had not even worn armor before, had stepped up and knocked the Philistine giant dead. At the start of chapter 18, we meet David riding on this crest of a wave. Nothing can go wrong for David. Life is peachy. The crowds love him. He is the top celebrity. Everybody adores David. You can imagine everyone trying to get up, trying to see this great celebrity of the day going through the crowds, the giant slayer among us. And it's amazing. And it's a scene full of rejoicing and joy because David was the hero. However, we're about to see that things in David's life are going to go a little bit pear-shaped. It's all going to change dramatically. Life is about to hot up. Difficulties and challenges are lining up before David. And as we proceed through the chapter, we're going to notice this. God is going to help David through each of those times of testing. We're going to find out how God will guide, how God will prepare, how God will lead David through the storms of life that will come upon him. And so this evening, I would like to divide this chapter into three sections and try to see the general principles from this chapter that we can glean for ourselves here in Edinburgh. So the first thing we have in verses 1 to 5 is God's provision. God's provision, verses 1 to 5. Then we have from verses 6 to verse 27, God's testing produces dependency. God's testing produces dependency, verses 6 to 27. And then finally, God is our shade, or God is our shelter, in verse 28. Now, it is incredible that June is coming. It doesn't feel very summery, but I'm sure some of us will be about to start the whole process of packing, getting ready for the great trips that we will be involved with over the summer holidays. The car gets packed, it's double packed, everything's thrown in, things are taken out, we've got too much, move it to this and this and this. So we'll all be going through this preparation for going on these great journeys. We'll all check the passports, we'll all check the money, we'll all do all these sorts of things. And because we do this because we know how frustrating it is when you forget your passport and you arrive at the airport. We know how frustrating it is when you arrive at holiday and you haven't got your flip-flops, for example. I've never been disappointed by that personally, but I'm told it's quite a disastrous moment for some of you. And so we do this, we check and double-check because we want to avoid any frustrations on the road. We want to minimize the difficulties as we travel and as we go to our destination. And in many ways, what we have in verses 1 to 5 is God getting David ready for his journey ahead. A journey that starts in Bethlehem, that goes through the valley of Elah and onto the throne room in Jerusalem. God is providing for the long and hard road that David has to travel. God knows exactly what's ahead of David. And he is not going to allow David to go out unprepared, but God is going to equip him for the road ahead, the road that will go from his family home to the throne room in Jerusalem. How does God do this, though? How does God prepare David for this journey from shepherd boy to king? It's quite a jump. Well, God gives David a friend who will be like a brother to him, one who would become one spirit with David. In the midst of all the praise, in the midst of the adulation that David rightly received, there was a man who would become David's closest friend and ally, one who would care for David, one who had David's best interests in mind, and wouldn't use David for what David could give to him, but who would love David as David and not as Israel's celebrity warrior. In verse 1, we notice that as David and King Saul reflect upon all that's happened in the Valley of Elah, as they sit and discuss this great victory, how this shepherd boy has defeated the most feared Philistine, waiting in the wings is Saul's son, Jonathan. And Jonathan's kind of listening in. And as he listens, and as he hears all the talk of what's happened, his heart grows warm towards David. He falls increasingly in love with this man, David. He thinks, that is a hugely admirable man that's sitting there with my father. This guy is something special. And so we have, over the next 5 verses, this friendship displayed to us, this deep friendship which would start here in the throne room and which would develop and blossom over the years. And the first thing we note about the friendship is this. Jonathan commits himself to David. Verse 3. Jonathan and David make a covenant. Now, this was commitment at an extraordinary level. This was not 20-something men making silly promises to one another. This covenant is deadly serious. For Jonathan, it meant assisting David to escape from his father, the king. And for David, this meant looking after Saul's servant Mephibosheth for Jonathan's sake. I'm amazed I got that Mephibosheth out. The act of making a covenant at that time involved
cutting an animal in half. And then what would happen, once you'd cut the animal in half, both Jonathan and David would walk between the two pieces of the animal. And what it's saying is this, if I do not fulfill my covenant, if I do not keep my side of the bargain, may what has happened to this animal happen to me. I should be killed and split in two if I do not follow through on this covenant. Jonathan and David are committed to ensuring that this friendship remains, and that it remains until one of them dies. Now, the second thing we see about this friendship is startling. Jonathan gives up everything that was rightfully his to David. In verse 4, we see Jonathan sacrificing his position and status for David. He does this by handing to David his tunic, his sword, his bow, and his belt. These possessions all signified Jonathan's position in life. They were all wrapped up in his status as a prince. Jonathan is here declaring to David that all the riches and trappings that are mine to inherit are to be yours, David. This is Jonathan stating, I will not be King Jonathan. This is Jonathan giving up his birthright. This is Jonathan giving up his crown to David. Try to imagine all that Jonathan's doing here. He is giving up everything so that God's man can sit on the throne. It's astonishing, his humility. He knows that David is God's chosen leader. He knows that naturally he stands in the way of David becoming the next king of Israel. And so with great humility, Jonathan submits to God's will and demonstrates that he will lay aside his claim to kingship so that David can become king. God provides for David a friend like no other to assist him on the road to the throne. One who will commit himself to David, and one who will give up his royal privilege for David. And as we see the sustaining nature of their friendship, we can draw a loose parallel between Jonathan and David's friendship on one hand, and our friendship with Jesus on the other. In John 15, verses 13 to 15, we have these words. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. For everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. Jesus calls his disciples friends. And by extension, all followers of Jesus are referred to as his friends. Our friendship with Christ is so much greater and deeper than Jonathan's friendship with David. Now, our relationship with Christ is bound to be different than the relationship which is portrayed between David and Jonathan. David and Jonathan are flawed human beings. They were both fallen. They both had faults. They both had shortcomings. And with that comes a certain equality. One was no greater than the other. However, Christ is perfect. He is both fully God and fully man. And because he is fully God, we cannot relate to him as an equal, but because he is fully man, we can have a real friendship with him. That's a remarkable statement. We as Christians are friends of Christ. That must be our huge encouragement. We have a friend who has bound himself to us, who has covenanted to ensure that we remain friends and that we receive all the blessings that this involves. We can become friends with the one who gave up all that was rightfully his, and who stepped off his throne to come into our world, to die in our place, so that we can become heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ. Like David, we don't know the path that our life will lead. And like David, God has provided for us a friend. But we have provided for us a true and perfect friend, one who will be with us throughout our life's journey here on earth, no matter how difficult it becomes. Christ with us is our great assurance. No matter the time, no matter the place, no matter the situation, Christ is with us. David had an extraordinary bond with Jonathan. But as Christians, we have a bond with God and not with a man. We have a friendship with a God who binds himself to us and who has given up his royal privilege for us. So the first thing we have is God's provision. And then we have verses 6 to 27. God's testing produces dependency. God's testing produces dependency. For David, it's been going so well. The giant was felled. The nation adored him. The king's son was now his dearest friend. What could go wrong? Life was pretty good for David. However, things are about to change, and change dramatically. As the hero returned, the streets were lined with people trying to snatch a view of this warrior king. And as David and Saul drew near to home, the women had composed a little song for their conquering hero. Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. It's hard to believe, but this little ditty sends Saul over the edge. He is beside himself with jealousy. He is not, well, fair play, he deserves it. After all, he did kill him. Philistine. No, he is enraged by it. He is burning with anger at this slight. Saul declares, what more can he get but the kingdom? Saul is clearly on edge. He knows his days are numbered, and he must be reflecting on what God had declared previously to Saul in Samuel 15, verse 28. The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. He naturally concludes that this David could be the one to whom the Lord wishes to hand over his kingdom to. And as Saul is burning up with anger inside, he begins to concoct various plots and plans to hold on to his kingship and to ensure that God's declaration will not come true. He is going to try and oppose God's will. And so the first assault on David's life occurs in verses 10 to 11. There is nothing subtle about it. Saul wants David speared against the wall. Not one attempt, but two attempts on the harpist warrior. The second test is a bit more subtle, and we find his second test in verse 13. It looks like a well-deserved promotion. It seems to be the dream job for David. David's going to be a commander of 1,000 men. This 20-something is going to take control of 1,000 soldiers. That's unheard of at the time. You would never, ever take control of a unit of soldiers at the age of 20 during that era. But he's got the king's backing. He has the royal seal of approval. And so David leads out his unit of men. However, in verse 17, it soon becomes obvious that Saul's motives are hardly pure. It doesn't take a genius to see what Saul is up to here. He wants David on the battlefield for as long as possible, so he can be accidentally gotten rid of. He wants to give a eulogy about the warrior king. He doesn't want to give a great address to the warrior king. And so after David's first tour of duty, Saul recognizes that the kind of plan isn't really working out so well, that actually David's quite a good soldier, and that everything David does is actually working out really well for him. And so to keep David on the front line a little bit more, for a little bit longer, he uses his daughters as bait. David, I want you to marry my daughter Merab. Oh, you're not so sure about Merab? Well, here, have Michal. And you know what? I won't demand a huge dowry. Just simply kill for me 100 Philistines. It's a very sad and desperate Saul we're coming across in these verses. Remember, Saul had been really close to God. Saul had risen dramatically through the ranks. Saul was God's chosen king once. And now we have Saul resorting to underhand and cowardly plots to oppose God's appointed king. Saul is desperately trying to stop God's will, and he cannot accept that he is no longer in position as king over Israel. He is a dead king walking. And I suppose the immediate question we want to ask is this: why? Why does God allow David to undergo such testing? Why not just kill Saul and crown David? Well, what God's doing here is that he is preparing David for the throne. He is preparing David to lead his people. Before he does this, before David leads his people, God's people, he must learn to become dependent upon God. He must become dependent on the one who will place him on the throne. David must be fully aware that he is not able to get through life on his own strength, far less get this chosen nation through life by David's own strength. He must ensure that he walks in accordance with God's will. The king must rule under the authority of the King of Kings. These episodes of testing in David's life would continue, and they're going to intensify. But all the time, God is refining David, knocking the rough edges off, molding David into that man after God's own heart, so that David can rule in a way that Saul never ruled. So that David will rule as one who wished to follow God's plan and not his own plan. In our own lives, we face testing times. Times where we feel the heat, and we may wonder why. We may question the value of these periods of our life. But God can use these situations to ensure that we become ever more reliant on Him, that we may become more dependent on Him, so that we can become increasingly like Christ. And our assurance is this: that the God who guided David through his trials to prepare him for greater service in his kingdom is also using our trials to enable us to better serve our King. Our trials are not meaningless. They are not chance events put in our road by God. But God uses these trials so that we may better glorify our God and our King. Then finally, verses 28 to 30, God is our shelter. Today, we have seen rain like nothing else. I've nearly flooded my engine several times. And today, all I have seen as I've been driving around, because I've had to drive around today, it's been awful, are people running for shelter, trying to hide from the rain. Well, it seems like the North Sea, really, over the top of us. And so, throughout this chapter, we have had David feeling the intense rage of Saul's anger raining down on him. Remember back in verse 8, as Saul's jealousy engulfs him, he turns all his anger and hatred towards the shepherd boy David. During these times of testing, where the king of Israel is committed to David's downfall, David rests under the shelter of the Lord. He stays close to the Almighty in his time of trouble. David keeps close to God, and as he dwells in the shelter of God, he is guided through life's storms. And in the storms of life, he can experience the comfort that the Lord brings. Throughout the passage, we see the refrain, "The Lord is with David, the Lord is with David." We have in verses 12, 14 and 28. Noticeably, this phrase is used after times of intense trial. It occurs after Saul's spear, verse 12, after his military campaigns in verse 14, and after Saul's attempts to use his daughters as bait to bring about his demise in verse 28. If we are Christians, we, like David, have the Lord with us. This is our great source of comfort during those times of testing that come our way. The Lord protects us. We are under his shelter, and he is watching over us. He is ensuring that we will get through the trials. During this testing time for David, a most striking aspect of David's character shines through, and that's his humility. He is absolutely but adored by multitudes. Six times the verb to love is used with David as the object. 1 3 16 20 22 28. Everyone seems to love David. Jonathan loves David. Michal loves David. The women of Israel love David. The soldiers love David. Now, with all his love and adulation coming toward David from all different directions, it would have been tempting, wouldn't it, to let this go to his head. He could have used his position to fuel his ego, to become an arrogant warrior who cared nothing or little for anyone or anything else, only caring about his own happiness and what could bring him joy. But David remains humble. He knows that God is the one who must be praised, not him. It was God, after all, who defeated Goliath. And it was God who enabled David to have success in the battlefield. And it was nothing to do with David. It was because of this humble spirit that God could lead and guide David through those difficult times. In Psalm 25, David penned these words, "He guides the humble in what is right and teaches them his way." It was because David was willing to follow God's plan that he was able to steer through the storm of Saul's anger. As we go through times of testing, do we humbly rely on God to see us through, or do we try to figure it out ourselves? Like David, we must humbly dwell near God when the tests of life come. We may be tempted to try and fix it ourselves, but the lesson we learn from this passage is that we must remain under the Lord's protective shelter. God alone will be able to steer us through the tests of life. If we do this, if we humble ourselves and allow God to lead us and direct us, we will ensure that God will be glorified even when life is at its most difficult. In conclusion then, we have seen in this passage that God will help us through the trials of life. God has given us Christ, who was willing to lay aside the riches of heaven so that we may have a living relationship with God. Remember also that God uses our trials for His glory, and that as we go through times of testing, let us humbly remain close to God so that He can guide us through them.